From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Michael Warren, White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A list of questions that were generated by the Office of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller for a potential deposition of President Donald Trump gave for the first time a clear picture of the direction that the investigation is taking and what concerns the prosecutor has about possible collusion and obstruction of justice by candidate and President Trump. At the same time, the president's legal team went through yet another shakeup, adding former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, whose first public interviews after taking the job may have hurt the president's case rather than help it. President Donald Trump earlier this week approved another month of relief from steel and aluminum tariffs for key allies, including the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. Tariffs were also at the heart of discussions between a U.S. trade delegation and Chinese officials in Beijing as the Trump administration sought to address its multiple complaints about Chinese trade practices. And in Afghanistan, multiple bombings in Kabul and Kandahar that took scores of innocent lives, combined with reported military gains by insurgents, called into question the U.S. plan to bring stability to the country. Let's get started with the Mueller questions. There always seems to be breaking news when it comes to the Mueller investigation, and this week was no different, as a list of some 40 or so questions was leaked to the press that would be potentially asked by the prosecutor in a potential interview and or deposition of the president. I'm going to start with you, Laura. Can you give us some insight into what some of the questions were and what did they tell you about the way the Mueller team is thinking?
Well, the questions dealt with several topics. It was an expansive list. Some of it dealt with Michael Flynn, the president's short-term national security advisor who was fired soon after the administration began and who had lied about meeting with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. Some of it dealt with that and what the president knew about that, what the reaction was to news information about that. Some of it dealt with Jim Comey, the fired FBI director, and some of it dealt with the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has not, unlike the first two, has not been fired, but who President Trump is amused openly about his displeasure with his recusal from the Russia investigation and essentially about how the president viewed Attorney General Sessions' decisions about recusal. And also, of course, there were some questions dealing about the presidential campaign and its conversations with and dealings with Russia. Of course, we know Russia meddled in the U.S. election. So the question being, of course, you know, was there any communication or so-called collusion between the parties? So I think that what this all kind of adds up to, I mean, it's a long list. All these topics have been out there for a long time. I mean, none of this is like real surprising, right?
Correct.
But, you know, it seems like what they are trying to get at is issues of obstruction of justice. That seems to be the issue more than did the collusion. You know, if you listen to the president talk about there's no collusion, no collusion, he just says that over and over again. And that may be very well true. But then there are questions of did he, because of his worries and nervousness about this investigation, because of concerns about where it was going or concerns about how it would affect others in Oktober, did he inappropriately intervene? Did he obstruct justice? So that seemed to be where those questions were headed.
And Michael, I totally agree with what Laura said. It seems to be more about the obstruction and the things that have happened. The other thing that struck me was the fact that there were a lot of open questions, no yes, no closed questions. So what do you think? What is your state of mind? What were you after? What is your purpose? What is your take on the questions? And also, is it significant that this leaked at all? Because this is, in fact, the first leak of any type of information we've had from this Mueller office.
Yeah, I think actually the question of who leaked it, how it leaked, would explain a lot about sort of how to interpret these questions. It's not clear. The New York Times, who first reported on these questions, claims that it did not get it from the Mueller team, but claims it got it from someone outside of Trump's legal team. Well, what does that mean? It's kind of a very vague explanation. It does seem to me that I agree with Laura that the focus of the questions that were leaked seemed to be on questioning the president about possible obstruction of justice, which would cut different ways depending on who exactly leaked the questions.
Yeah.
There's a possibility that these questions were leaked as a way to shore up a view that the Trump legal team may be taking, which is the best possible way to get out of this situation for the president would be to demonstrate that what Mueller is doing, what the special counsel is doing, is a fishing expedition, that the, that what the special counsel is doing is trying to go after crimes or potential wrongdoing committed during the investigation, not the Russia collusion question, which is the sort of central part of the investigation. I think that is an effort that they're making to claim that that the Mueller investigation has gone too far, and maybe even setting up a predicate to make some moves, as the president tweeted this week, possibly make some moves against folks at the Justice Department, particularly Rod Rosenstein, who is the Deputy Attorney General who is in charge of the Mueller investigation.
And to pick up the thread on Rod Rosenstein, he said that he would not be intimidated by the calls from Congress to release unredacted information to congressional committees who are seeking that information, some say to release it directly to the White House as a defense against the investigation itself. With Rosenstein being in this embattled position, have the events of the week affected his position in any way? Is he any more likely to be fired, stay on, or either direction?
I honestly don't know. I mean, these things are just so up in the air. I don't know if anybody's position is really secure in this administration, truth be told. I will say there has been more, as you say, more focus on him, because he really, even though he's somebody who most people, you know, even in this country, have probably never heard of, he is a very important figure because the Attorney General has recused himself. As Michael said, he's the guy who's in charge. So if, in fact, the president wanted to fire Mueller, he really needs to fire Rosenstein. So there's attacks on him on Capitol Hill. There's like a whole machinery that is falling into place to try to be supportive of the White House. And part of that being supportive of the White House is going after Rod Rosenstein.
And just constraining that investigation in any way possible, it seems that. And even if it takes creating a quote-unquote constitutional crisis by firing this individual. Let's talk a little bit about the staffing of the president's legal team. Ty Cobb, his attorney, is out, and he's been replaced by Emmett Flood, a fairly well-known Washington lawyer who has some familiarity with things like impeachment. And Rudy Giuliani, who former head of the Southern District in the United States as a U.S. attorney, mayor of New York City, a very high-profile individual. Talk a little bit about Emmett Flood, Rudy Giuliani, the sort of the juxtaposition of those two people as attorneys,
sure,
and what their roles will be on that team as you see it.
Well, as you said, Michael, Flood will be replacing Ty Cobb in the White House, so that this will be a sort of West Wing job for him. He is a lawyer who has experience. He was on President Bill Clinton's legal team when the president was going through impeachment. A lot of people are seeing parallels here in Washington.
Not difficult to see that.
Exactly. But Flood does have a lot of respect sort of in the Washington legal community. So it's seen perhaps as a defensive position. And contrast that with the selection of Rudy Giuliani to lead the outside legal team for the president. He's replacing John Dowd, who left the legal team a couple of weeks ago. John Dowd is sort of a veteran Washington lawyer. He was sort of one of the few Washington lawyers who was willing and able to join the president's legal team. Rudy Giuliani, yes, he's a lawyer. He was a federal prosecutor and obviously mayor of New York City, but he comes into this position less for his legal expertise and more for what we saw from Rudy Giuliani this week, which was his ability to go into the media and make a public case on behalf of the president and the president's legal strategy. That's what we saw in his appearance on the Fox News Channel, on Sean Hannity's show on Wednesday night, in which which Rudy Giuliani revealed quite a bit of new information about the James Comey firing, about the Stormy Daniels, the porn star who is alleged to have had an affair with the president and was paid off by the president's lawyer, Michael Cohen, revealed more information about that, which I think goes to what I was talking about earlier, which is an effort, at least by the outside legal team, to really sort of make this a political and a PR fight against the Mueller investigation.
That seems like the effort. Michael just pointed to the ability of Rudy Giuliani to make this case in public. I will vouch for his willingness to do so. I'm not so sure about his ability. Would you rate that performance?
Well, I mean, let's just go back to one of the points Michael made, then sort of unpack that a little bit about the Stormy Daniels situation, because I think that was the most interesting piece of that Rudy Giuliani coming out. And so, okay, so as listeners may recall, Stormy Daniels, adult film actress, alleged to have had a sexual encounter with President Trump a few years ago, and she was paid for her silence, you know, just a couple weeks before the election. So President Trump had said that he didn't know anything about it, and asked Michael Cohen. He doesn't know why she got paid. So then the question that's been swirling is, well, if Michael Cohen paid her off not to talk right before the election, was that essentially a campaign contribution? Was he essentially spending money to help the Trump campaign? Okay, so that question is out there. Now, what Rudy Giuliani seemed to be trying to shut that line of inquiry down by saying, no, Michael Cohen wasn't doing this. In fact, President Trump knew about this, and it was his money. He was paying for this. But then that just opens a whole nother kettle of fish, because it's like, oh, okay. So,
which was Donald... Sean Hannity's quote.
Yeah, so that's actually famous. What Sean Hannity said.
Oh, okay.
I did not recall that, which I loved.
But
I'm glad to be in the same company as a more experienced broadcaster. But in any case, the president, in fact, knew about this. He's the one who's, in fact, paying this woman off. But nothing happened. He's still denying the affair. So it's all just... the more this thing swirls, the more it just comes back on itself. You try to plug one hole and then another one opens up.
Yeah, it seems to me as though at the end of the day, we talk about this in terms of the legal issues, but politically, at the end of the day, with Trump having his base be so strong, it's as strong as it ever was. We still have a Republican House and Senate. He's obviously still in the White House. Politically, does it really make any difference? And we might not get to see that for quite some time. And we're going to have to take a break real quick right there, and we'll come back with more issues in the news.
Thanks for tuning in to Issues in the News on the Voice of America. If you'd like to download a podcast, just click on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Laura Meckler, a staff writer for The Wall Street Journal. And Michael Warren, White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard. Our moderator is Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor here in Washington.
Back to the issues. The Trump administration postponed the imposition of tariffs on steel and other products with key allies as they seek to address trade issues on a bilateral basis with a range of our closest allies, rather than enter into these standard agreements and large-scale agreements that have been the norm for the last couple of generations. Michael, you have some experience in this. Who are the countries involved, and what does the administration want from them?
Well, there's a whole host of countries. There's Canada, there's Mexico, there's a whole bunch of countries that the United States has traded with regularly. So we should back up and point out that this was a couple of months ago that the administration announced these steel and aluminum tariffs. It was met with a lot of surprise. And not just a lot of surprise by those countries that we trade with, but in fact, surprise within the White House. A feeling that these tariffs were introduced sort of willy-nilly and in a way that the rest of the administration was just not prepared for. And you can see this when you talk to, as I have, with members of the White House team that worked on the China tariffs, the planned China trade actions, which is that they say this off the record, that the aluminum tariffs, the steel tariffs that the administration has been pushing, sort of caught them off guard and cut against their efforts to really make a strong case against bad Chinese trading practices. So what we've seen in the intervening weeks is a pullback from the administration, saying, "We'll give you dispensations at this country, that particular country." And I think that reflects from the administration a sort of a very quick action that was not actually that well thought out, and sort of reflected the president's own desire to have some quick action on these steel and aluminum tariffs, and the sort of grown-ups, if you will, in the administration are sort of having to play cleanup at this point.
Mm-hmm. And Laura, the leaders of France and Germany were in town recently and made personal pleas about for holding off on tariffs, not only in the short term, but indefinitely. Is there any indication that they, there is some indication, obviously, that they were successful in the short term. Is there any indication that they'll be successful in the long term?
Well, they left without any reassurances. So they were disappointed about that. They wanted, you know, some sort of a concession or reassurance to come out of those meetings. It didn't apparently come out. Maybe, in fact, they did make their case. This has been pushed down the road. And, you know, Washington has a tendency, I'd say in many administrations, to just kind of push hard things down the road. So, you know, it's delayed for a month and, well, let's see what happens. And then maybe it's another month. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with this, but I do think that that is, you know, that is a possibility. But, you know, at the same time, you know, administration officials are saying that they are did get some concessions from other countries like Argentina, Brazil, Australia, that they agreed to quotas on their imports or exports to this country. So I do think that while Trump's approach is certainly, shall we say, unconventional, and it's a lot of people really are disturbed by it, essentially by this threats and this specter of a trade war. He's out there using this as a threat with these damaging trade tariffs if they don't do what we want. And in some cases, it's having some effect. But of course, the goal of these original, what most economists will tell you and people will say that where the real problem is with China. You know, China dumping cheap steel onto the market. Of course, you know, the rest of the world's like, well, why do I have to pay for China's sins? But, you know, they are. So that's where the administration's having to navigate things. But as they try to go after what they view as the real problem.
And that's a perfect segue into the Chinese trade talks. That trade imbalance, the imbalance in steel, has been a drumbeat for the administration since the early days of the campaign. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin met with Chinese officials. But is there any indication, Michael, that anything significant will come out of those talks?
No. In fact, there are already reports that the only agreement that has been coming out of these talks is an agreement to have more talks and have more discussion. Look, I think that this is an issue on China, bad Chinese trade practices that, unlike the steel and aluminum tariffs, the administration had been preparing for quite some time. They released a report out of the U.S. Trade Representative's office that was very detailed. And in fact, you won't find much disagreement throughout people here in Washington who understand what's going on with China about the diagnosis of the problem with China, of everything they're doing, from steel dumping to they didn't go so far as to say currency manipulation, but that's always sort of hanging around there. And of course, just various bad intellectual property theft issues. The question is, what does the White House and what does the administration want to do? And a big problem with this delegation that's gone to China to negotiate this is you've got multiple people in that delegation who disagree with each other. There are people
on
like
the U.S. side.
On the U.S. side, yes, yes. And this is sort of hard to fathom, but this is a White House and administration. We saw the departure, for instance, of Gary Cohn, who's the National Economic Council director, over the question of these steel and aluminum tariffs. There's many people still on the staff at the White House who share his more open trade view of things. And then you have someone like Peter Navarro, who's the president's top trade advisor, who views tariffs against China as sort of an unalloyed good and something that can benefit the United States economy. That is not a view that's shared by most people in the Trump White House and within the administration. And that's causing, I think, some cognitive dissonance with this group who's gone to China to negotiate, because the Chinese really sort of don't know really what the administration is ultimately going to do and where their heart and where their views really are.
And I'm going to stay with you, Michael, for this last question. What level of importance are the efficacy of these particular trade talks in relation to the upcoming negotiations with North Korea? Is China going to use a carrot and stick situation, saying if we do not get concessions as far as these trade issues, you will not be able to count on our cooperation in those particular talks?
That's much harder to answer that question, because so much of what China has been doing with regard to these upcoming North Korea talks has been sort of behind the scenes. It's sort of in many ways a separate issue. You talk to people here in Washington who say China has been a big part in this more aggressive approach to getting North Korea to come to the talks. I can't imagine that the Chinese are too interested in intermingling these trade issues with something that has to do more immediately with national security. China doesn't like the fact that North Korea has these nuclear weapons and may be able to deploy it, maybe almost as much as the United States is not happy with it.
Let's shift to another topic that is disconcerting to say the least. Coordinated suicide bomb attacks near the Afghan Intelligence Agency building in Kabul killed at least 25 people and wounded dozens more, including, I believe, 9 journalists is the correct number. In a separate attack in the southern city of Kandahar, 11 school children were killed, 16 hurt when a suicide bomber in a truck there targeted NATO-led forces. There are also reports independently that the number of Afghan forces are well below prescribed levels and that ISIS and Taliban forces are making territorial gains. Laura, do these events, these bombings, and these reports of depleted forces represent a change in the fortunes of this, what is now the largest ongoing conflict in U.S. history? Is this in any way a pivot point, or is it just a continuation of something that's been going on for a very long time now?
Frankly, it strikes me as just a continuation. I mean, and not just since 2001. I mean, Afghan has just suffered wave after wave of civil war, of unrest, foreign...
Centuries, we're talking.
Yes, of foreign invasions, I mean, including the United States, but not limited to. It's just such a troubled country, and we are so stuck in what's happening there. I mean, we probably could have talked about Afghanistan on almost any given week over the past, what's it been now, 16 years. And it's hard to imagine a lot of those weeks would have been like, things are going great. I mean, in fact, things have been going very poorly. This week is particularly sad. I mean, for journalists in particular,
room.
Obviously, 9 journalists targeted and killed. But of course, there are people being killed, you know, all the time there. So yes, I think this is very, very troubling. And I honestly don't know. I don't know if, I mean, there's been efforts to try to find a way out, try to find a negotiated settlement. But when you're dealing with the Islamic State as one of the actors, you know, this is not about, you know, negotiating between, you know, Republicans and Democrats. You know, when you think that's hard, try negotiating with the Islamic State. There's no easy answers here.
No, there aren't. And just to circle back on the journalist thing, because we are sitting in a room full of journalists in a building that has supported journalists for decades. It was reported that one of the bombers was actually disguised as a journalist,
yes,
which I found particularly chilling somehow. So just wanted to mention that.
And in Afghanistan, there's been a sort of a ray of hope in this very troubled country, is that journalists have had a very good level of freedom in that country, particularly for that part of the world. The other thing I'll say about this is that, you know, President Trump was very reluctant to continue the United States involvement in Afghanistan. And he was really sort of pulled along by a number of his top national security and military aides on this. You do have to wonder if the latest developments here don't obviously frustrate the president and maybe make him reassess a South Asian policy that he has gotten behind, I would say, very reluctantly.
Well, the U.S. had pledged at the beginning of this year increases in airstrikes, drone attacks on insurgent leaders, and all of that has happened. And yet, it seems not to have made a substantial difference. If anything, measurably, the situation has depleted. So is there any word out of the Defense Department, out of the Pentagon, about another shift, an increased commitment in forces, deployments, anything of that nature?
No. Secretary James Mattis has had the ability, has had the authority to basically determine troop levels in Afghanistan. The president gave him that authority. And I think that this is something that obviously is going to be discussed, is almost certainly already being discussed. But I don't know if there's been any real shift in strategy or policy on the troop levels. But I will say the other thing is that the administration has made a point publicly of saying that they've decimated ISIS, they decimated the Islamic State. And that is true to a certain extent in eastern Syria and northern Iraq, although if you talk to people on the ground, they say there are actually still a lot of pockets of ISIS waiting to be reactivated. But the point of ISIS in Afghanistan is something that I don't think is certainly on the radar of American voters, and is something that cannot be underestimated as a serious problem for the Americans as they try to figure out what to do in Afghanistan.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, and Laura Meckler, staff writer for the Wall Street Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor in Washington. Thanks for listening.